Welcome, everybody. This week's Parsha is Parsha's Bow. And the title of the class is, Are You Still Afraid of the Dark? I got some shake. Yeah, Rabbi, I am. Thanks for mentioning. We're going to start with a video. This is from a relatively new movie, TV series on NBC called New Amsterdam. Let me watch it. Okay. This is not an endorsement, just using it for education purposes. Okay, so anyways, it's about, the scene is, it's going to take us into the scene of Dr. Fromm. He's a psychiatrist who's, like I said, of a department at Bellevue. And he's discussing with his, with a therapist about, he has this, he just, He without asking his partner, he went ahead to go adopt a foster child. So that's an issue. So we're gonna get to the okay, some feedback here, hold on. But guys, put everybody on pause on mute. Let's hear. Okay, better. You gotta mute yourself. Let's go to the share screen. There we go. Do I see this is Dr. Fromm. He's the chair of behavioral health at the hospital. Okay. Here's the screen. You guys see it? Scott, you see the screen? Good. All right. Here we go.
How do you feel when you help someone?
Like I'm here for a reason.
So how do you feel when you don't? Everyone in the department heard about the time that you gave your shoes to a homeless man. Well, imagine that you just walked by him. How would you have felt?
Like a bad person. And I would have been. He needed shoes. That's what you do.
Well, a lot of people walk by him. Are they all bad people?
No, not at all.
So why are you... Can you try and list three good things about yourself that have nothing to do with helping? Three things that would be great about yourself if you never adopt another kid or rescue another goat. How about one thing? Dr. Fromm, what do you think would happen if you stopped helping people?
They'd see,
Vicky, what would they see?
They would see what a complete loser I am. Just corny, nerdy, fat, worthless, nothing.
Baby.
No, I know it's not healthy. And I have this voice in my head, and it's a really loud one. And it's saying that one of these days you're gonna realize that you can do so much better than me. My ability to help people. That's all I have. That's the only thing I even like about myself. Without that, I just can't think of a reason why you would keep me around. I can't.
Dr. Fromm, I'm going to ask Martin to do something now, and it would be great if you could just sit and listen. Is that okay?
Okay.
Martin, will you tell your husband three things that you think are good about him?
kind. You are a wonderful father. And you are beautiful. You're hilarious. You're patient. You're smart. You make friends everywhere you go because they see what I see. You shine. You're amazing. You're the love of my life. And my life is so much better than I ever thought it was going to be because of you, Iggy.
All right.
I love you.
All right. All right. Okay. Okay. All right, let's do a little, we'll get to the sheet. Okay, question number one. What extreme acts of chastity did Dr. Fromm do?
Giving away the shoes he was wearing?
Gave away his shoes he was wearing, this is talking about in New York, to a homeless person who he saw had no shoes. Okay.
He can't stop adopting kids that he meets. Right.
Yeah. So, what act of chesed triggered the crisis in his life?
And unplanned adoption.
Well, you want to get to do it without discussing it with his partner.
Right. Unplanned.
Okay. Good.
Wait, how many kids did he adopt altogether?
I haven't watched the series. I don't know, but. That's the background. That was just right before. why does Dr. Fromm have such difficulty in becoming aware of his deep insecurity about his worthlessness? Why does he have a difficulty becoming aware of that?
Wait, I don't understand.
There's a step prior. What is causing this? The therapist asked him a question. Oh, why did you give the homeless person shoes? Because he needed shoes.
He feels like he's not worthy. Right.
Then she asked him a question. But other people walked by the guy. Are they bad people? And then he said no. Oh, so then would you be a bad person? In other words, if he was consistent, you should say, yeah, they are bad people for not helping the homeless person out. He didn't go that way. He said, no, they're not bad. So then she got him into a contradiction. So then why are you bad for walking past the homeless person? And then what was his basic answer?
That he wasn't good enough to be with his partner.
Well, he feels that the only redeeming quality that he has is his kindness, the fact he's a Baal Chesed. He says the only thing he likes about himself is the fact that he gives Chesed. So, okay, so that was an awareness, that was a breakthrough. And then this is obviously a couple therapy. So why does Dr. Fromm have such difficulty becoming aware of his deep insecurity about his feeling of worthlessness? You know, why did it take an act of therapy? Why didn't he just, why is he
it
not?
It got to a point where, like, nobody really said anything to him. Then it just reached this tipping point. It got to, like, you know, our house is only so big. Finances are only so much to take care of, like, all these people.
I mean, So he was confronted by his partner that this is a psychological problem. They brought in an expert. Ironically, he himself is a department head of psychology. He himself is a psychologist. Why did he himself need a therapist himself to explore this?
because sometimes we have like trouble pointing out our own flaws.
Yes. Let's expand upon that. Correct. Got you 100% correct. It's not only that. What else is challenging?
You can only see things from your point of view.
True, but most people don't like to think about themselves at all. You know, in the sense of thinking about their behavior. In other words, reviewing their behavior, think into their behavior. Well, why did I do that? What was the trigger for that? You know what I'm saying? To be, in other words, even to be self-reflective is not a natural thing for people. And here in this, obviously this TV series, the character, Dr. Frum, he himself is a therapist, yet he required a separate therapist at a point of crisis to allow him to become self-aware. Now, what did he even reveal in the session? Obviously, this is a little bit, you know, Hollywood-esque, so it doesn't always happen like this in real life. But what did he also reveal about his sense of worthlessness, which is animating his need to do these extreme acts of chesed, Herculean chesed?
He's trying to make up for his sense of worthlessness by being so kind. And in that, he's trying to secure his future with his partner. His partner loves him only for that. So
that's his perception. His perception is if I see the only redeeming thing is my capacity to be a Baal Chesed, obviously the partner could only see that either. Right, he projected his evaluation on his, and then of course the therapist did was bring in the partner to say, list all the things that the other partner, the partner, values of him. Okay, now, what role does commitment to extreme chesed have in Dr. Frum's inability to become aware of his problem? His commitment to extreme chesed, what role does it have in him, in his inability to become aware of it? What role does that play?
It makes it seem not so bad because he is doing all these amazing things.
Well, he does the extreme chesed, makes himself feel worthy, and he doesn't have to think about why all the other qualities he has, which voices in his head think are worthless. He can avoid, in other words, doing the act of chesed allows him not to think about those voices that tell him he is worthless. He's valueless. So that's why he's constantly energized to go from one extreme act of chesed to the next, because it does two things. It gives him a sense of worthiness, A, and B, a way to escape thinking about the voices that tell him you're a loser, you're fat, you're stupid, you have nothing going on. I mean, obviously this is a TV depiction. But it touches upon a truth that even though that this guy is a beloved member of the staff, head of an entire department at a major a hospital in New York City, he feels bad. He feels like he's worthless. You know, so a person's self-esteem does not reflect based upon their resume. They can have tremendous accomplishments, external accomplishments, but internally feel terrible, or conversely, not have amazing accomplishments, but feel great, but have a sense of satisfaction with themselves. You know what I'm saying? Those things do not correlate one to another. Okay? All right.
So love seeing how these videos relate to the Parsha.
Well, that's what I hope I got you. I stimulated your curiosity on that.
You did.
Good. Yeah. So what does this clip have anything to do with the Parsha, which deals with, just as a review of the Parsha,
plagues.
The last three plagues, Parsha, locust, darkness, and the plague of the firstborn. Then Hashem tells Moshe to tell Jewish people the mitzvot of the Korban Pesach, the first Seder, the Brit Milah, setting up the Jewish calendar, the prohibition of Chametz, that there's going to be in the future, not year one, but in the future, that Pesach will be a seven-day holiday, the obligation to commemorate the Exodus. And then the last part of the Parsha deals with other mitzvot, which are there to always make us think about the Exodus. Number one, of course, being tefillin, the sanctification of the firstborn, male and animal. And basically, so it's all about commemorating the Exodus. That's the Parsha. So let's get into the plagues. Let's get into the plagues. All right, who would like to read? Sorry, Shmuel, go ahead.
Okay. locust, the eighth plague. God said to Moses, extend your hand over Egypt to bring the locusts, and they will emerge on Egypt. They will eat all the foliage in the land that was spared by the hail.
Okay.
Moses raised his hand
over. By the way, so as you know, the seventh plague was damaging hail, which destroyed all the trees and destroyed all the standing wheat. And basically, it was a disaster. Now, God is sending through Moshe a swarm of locusts. Go on.
Moses raised his hand over Egypt, and all that day and night, God made an east wind blow over the land. When morning came, the east wind was carrying the locusts. The locusts invaded Egypt, settling on all Egyptian territory. It was a very severe plague. Never before had there been such a locust plague. Never again would the like be seen. The locusts covered the entire surface of the land, making the ground black. They ate all the plants on the ground and all the fruit on the trees, whatever had been spared by the hail. Nothing green remained on the trees and plants throughout all Egypt.
Wait, stop right there. Why is this such a crushing and devastating blow?
Won't it lead to starvation?
Yeah, yes. Basically, their entire vegetable and plant-based part of their diet has now been destroyed. And the Torah does not mention this, but according to Egyptologists, interestingly enough, the Egyptians were vegetarian. So that is a terrible blow. So all they have left is their cattle and the fish of the Nile. And they're in a, you know, it's a bad shape. Go on.
Didn't the fish and cattle already get destroyed?
No.
Yeah, wasn't there a plague?
There was a plague on the cattle. Yes. Yeah. Apparently it was not all the cattle, because you see later on that Paro dispatches his horses to run after the Jews. So it was damaging, right? So they're down a lot of cattle. They lost a lot of cattle in the pestilence.
Right.
And Plague 5, I believe. Yeah, Plague 5. And so this is brutal. Let's keep on going, Shmuel.
I just have a weird question. I don't mean to get off topic, but I just have that. Made me think of something. Why would the Egyptians have any sizable amount of cattle or grazing animals if they're vegetarian?
For milk, for wool, for clothing.
I don't. Okay.
And also they use their remember their animals was their farm farm equipment, you know what I mean, to, you know, to draw, to move and pull a plow. And Egypt in the ancient time was viewed as the great producer of horses, the Mecca of horses. Go on.
Pharaoh hastily summoned Moses and Aaron, saying, "I have committed a crime," he said, both to God your Lord and to you. Now forgive my offense just this one more time. Pray to God your Lord, just take this death away from me." Moses left Pharaoh's presence and prayed to God. God turned the wind around, transforming it into a very strong west wind. It carried away the locusts and plunged them into the Red Sea. Not a single locust remained within all Egypt's borders. But once again, God made Pharaoh obstinate, and he would not let the Israelites leave.
Okay, so as throughout the entire series, as soon as the pain of the plague is removed, Pharaoh, in this case, God hardens his heart and does not release the Jews. Okay, that's plague 8. Let's keep on going to plague 9.
Shall I continue?
Shmuel, B'vaka Shah.
Okay. Darkness, the 9th plague. God said to Moses, "Reach out towards the sky with your hand, and there will be darkness in Egypt. The darkness will be palpable." Moses lifted his hand towards the sky, and there was an opaque darkness in all Egypt, lasting for 3 days. People could not see each other, and no one left his place for 3 days.
Excuse me.
Pardon me. The Israelites, however, had light in the areas where they lived. Pharaoh summoned Moses. "Go," he said, "worship God. Even your children can go with you. Just leave your sheep and cattle behind. Will you then provide us with sacrifices and burnt offerings so that we will be able to offer them to God our Lord?" replied Moses. Our livestock must also go along with us. Not a single hoof can be left behind. We must take them to serve God our Lord, since we do not know what we will need to worship him until we get there." God made Pharaoh obstinate, and he was no longer willing to let the Israelites leave. "Leave my presence," Pharaoh said to Moses. Don't dare see my face again. The day you appear before me, you will die." As you say, replied Moses, "I will not see your face again."
Okay. All right. So that's the that's darkness. Let's okay. All right. So take a look. All right. Let's read. All right. Parsha's book consists of the last few plagues in a series of ever increasing plagues: locust, darkness, and then next is the plague of the firstborn. So, is locust a highly destructive plague?
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's just, you're, as Ruthie pointed out, basically the destruction of the entire, food source, okay? Is the last plague of Makas Bechoros, the killing of the firstborn of Egypt, as well as the firstborn animals and their other gods. Obviously, the most intense, is that the worst one? Killing of the entire firstborns of Egypt? You say that's the worst one. Is Makas Bechoros the plague of the firstborn? Is that the worst one of the 10?
I think so.
Yeah,
it stands to reason if it's the climax. Yeah.
Right, and also in no other plague did people die. Here, clearly, a certain percentage of the population at the stroke of midnight are all dying. Okay, and not to mention their firstborn animals. Okay. So then, that of course brings us to the key question of the night. Why would darkness be the 9th plague? What's so difficult or challenging about sitting quietly in the dark? How could this plague top the destruction of Egypt's entire food supply? In other words, if the entire plagues are in ever-increasing severity, right, and you have locusts, which, as we said, is wiping out their food supply, and that's number 8, and number 10 is killing the firstborn and their animals and their gods, that being the worst, it doesn't seem that the 9th plague, 3 days of sitting in the dark, is so terrible. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't. In other words, I'm not saying it can't be a plague, but if I gave you 10 cards, right? And I said, arrange them from high to, from low to high in order of severity, would you put the plague of darkness as the number 9 most challenging plague?
I would think that by the description of it and given its place in the order, I would think that this level of darkness may have been akin to death.
But nobody died. They just couldn't see.
True, but it's. I mean, it sounds like it was to the degree that people were motionless.
Even if you're stuck in one place and you're nervous and you're scared to get up because you don't want to fall around, but still, why it doesn't, even if everything you're saying is correct.
If you can't get up, you can't use the bathroom. If you can't get up, you can't eat. You can't.
Now clearly it's not true because Paro was able to dispatch and bring Moshe to the palace.
Good point, right.
So it doesn't mean
that it's not darkness for the Jews, though, right?
But it's darkness to Paro. So he's bringing him into his palace. Right?
Well, I don't think that people were just, like, sitting in the dark for 3 days. I mean, it was, like, mass panic, mass hysteria. Like, everything is upside down. Nothing is understandable. Like, it's just complete chaos.
Okay, but would you put this as the, I'm not saying this is not a plague. Would you put this as the 9th worst plague?
Or
if you didn't know the order, and I said to you, I'm going to give you a description of the 10 plagues, and I want you to sequence them from the least challenging to the most challenging. Would you? And I'm just asking you straight. Would you guys have put the plague of darkness, Makas Choshech? Would you put it as the 9th most severe plague?
I think it's I don't know God's intentions, but I think it might be like a certain form of psychological torture to be stuck in a place of inaction and immobility when everything around you has kind of gone.
Ruthie lost you there. Ruthie, we don't hear you anymore.
Sorry, I think my internet went out for a second. And like they're stuck in the same place, like alone with their panicked thoughts and an inability to like do anything constructive. And I think that can be really torturous for people.
So you would put it as number 9.
I don't know if I would put it at number 9. I have to go back and look at all the other ones. But like I can see why it could be extremely torturous, is I guess.
Okay. Does anybody here think it should be number 9?
Definitely like one of the top ones because they didn't know how long the darkness was going to last.
Okay, good point.
And it's hard to say because we have like the perspective of history. Like we know it's coming back. So like I think it's hard to.
Yeah.
Hindsight's 20/20, yeah.
I mean, maybe the Egyptians historically were afraid of the dark and we don't know that. And that it was especially bad.
Didn't they have a sun god?
Ra, yeah. Right?
Yes.
So then imagine if our god was destroyed. That's probably how they were feeling. Their source of life, of everything, disappeared. They had no idea if it was coming back.
Okay.
We could say that about every plague was a direct attack on one of their quote unquote gods.
That is also true. The first one is blood. The Nile was viewed as a god. Frogs, in other words, that was also, by the way, they deified that as well. So that became out of control. Lice, wild animals, pestilence killing their animals. Then we had boils. Then you had hail. Then you had the locusts. Then you had the darkness. And then you had the first one. Let's read one of the commentaries on the Chumash is the Tor. He also wrote major work in halacha called the Arbaturim of the Shulchan Aruch. So he describes, he had maybe a midrashic approach, but what did the darkness, the plague of the darkness experience? All right, Sean, read out the tour over here.
Right, the darkness will be tangible. This expression describing touching something, as when Yaakov expressed his concern to his mother Rivka that his father, being blind, would subject him to the touch test.
In Bereshit, remember when the story is he vayimashet, in other words, vayimash, it means it's touch. Well, Yaakov was afraid to his mother Rivka that when Yitzchak will hear me, or he might touch me, and he's going to sense that I'm not, in fact, my hairy older brother Esau. I go on.
The darkness was so opaque that the people could feel it with their hands. The reason was that this darkness was not merely the absence of light of the sun, but it was caused by the descent of thick air into the lower atmosphere covering Egypt, Mithraim. This layer of thick air extinguished any candles or other artificial means of lighting the Egyptians would use at night to see by.
Right. So what the Torah is suggesting, because it says by mash echoshech, they would actually touch. It was akin to like a fog. You know what I'm saying? Like a fog, a thick fog. You could actually sort of had a sort of a tangible quality to it, and that blocked out all the light. Okay. All right. So I think that Ruthie was on to something. I want to give a sense of why, or what I would like to present tonight is why, to go in deeper, why this was such a terrifying experience. So I'm going to give you a scenario. All right. So let's have Suzanne read it out.
To appreciate this plague, let me give you a related example. You want to go camping. You drive up and then hike alone and no one is around for miles in a national park where there is no cell service, no electricity, absolutely no distractions from the outside world, and you realize that you left any reading material behind. It is just you and your thoughts. Then the night falls and there is no moon. It is pitch black. A new set of thoughts start to descend on you. Scary thoughts of terror by being attacked by animals or by other dangers seen in horror films, or spooky thoughts of demons or spirits attacking, like in a scene in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, when he sees the Dementor on the train trying to suck out his soul.
Okay. Now with this image, we can understand how Makas Choshech, darkness, was so profoundly terrifying to the idolatrous and conflicted Egyptians. Okay? What three factors determine how difficult the experience of the plague of Makas Choshech? Would be. Give me three aspects of why this was absolutely terrifying.
Could they, well, the unknown, they don't know what's lurking in that dark.
Yes. Correct. What else?
They don't know when it's going to end. Like, this could be the new normal. End.
Correct. What else?
There's the inability to do anything, like to see anything.
Everything they do, they can't light anything, they can't.
Right, so first of all, nowadays, because we have this thing called the phone, as been, you know, we're not bored anymore. Do you remember as a kid where, I don't know if you were like in school and let's say you were doing the standardized testing or whatever, and they gave you 3 hours for the test, and once you were done, you couldn't leave your seat? But you couldn't do anything. You had to literally sit in your chair, and you can look over your test. But you had to sit in that chair till it was out. And sometimes, let's say you only use 2 hours and 15 minutes of the 3 hours. You had to sit at that chair for 45 minutes tell me, how did that feel? You can't look at the phone. You can't read anything. You can't watch any TV. You can't talk to anybody.
It's terrible. It's torture.
It's torture. Right. So not able to distract your mind with anything is absolutely torture. So first factor is the boredom factor. Being stuck in one place with no stimulation for 3 days is, first of all, the torture of boredom. Okay? Not 50, it's not 45 minutes. It's 3 days. It's essentially, they were basically put into what? Solitary confinement. Even when in our prison system, when somebody's extremely hostile and not cooperative, and they punish them, and they put them in solitary confinement, even that, what's the limit? Even when they do that, what do they always do? You guys seen some prison movies?
They get like 1 hour a day, right?
They get 1 hour a day. Scott, exactly right. In other words, they get put out to live to walk around the prison yard, because otherwise it's viewed as a cruel and inhuman punishment. Even somebody in—I don't know if it's true, but you know, at least in movie land, that's true. So being stuck in solitary confinement and just with your thoughts for days, everything is simply a torture. That's number one. Now, let's go into the world of the Egyptian. What was the world of the Egyptian like? What did the Egyptians believe in? Did Egyptians believe in ghosts?
Probably. Spirits, yeah. Maybe?
Did they believe in spirits?
Yeah, like their ancestors.
Did they believe in demons?
Yes.
First of all, most people today believe in all that. All right, so certainly, but imagine in a pre-scientific world what these people are believing in. Okay, so these people are, so they're, every noise that they hear in their dark, solitary confinement thing, now maybe they could, you know, they could squirm, walk, like a blind person to the bathroom, you know, or some, you know, whatever, but still, they're completely in a state of torture over here, right? And therefore, they get the waiting for anything to happen. And they have, as was said before, they have no control. They can't go out. They probably can't readily get any food, whatever. They can sort of fumble around, or if they remember in the other room they had a bag of oranges, whatever, they might be able to somehow get there. But it was basically in solitary confinement, bored, alone with their thoughts, which is then, of course, scaring them out by having all these senses. They just came off 8 other plagues. Their whole world is upside down. They're completely being tortured. And they have little, they can't do anything about it. And this, and also the darkness is some, has a very unnatural quality to it. In other words, it's sort of like a gas, like a fog. It completely does not allow any light to permeate in it. There's a debate among the Rishonim whether or not a candle would work or would not work. Okay, so the Torah says it would not work, even if just the candles would work, but it would not really shed so much light. It would be very, very limited. Okay, but the reason that the ninth plague is horrible, because basically it's basically psychological warfare of the highest degree. Like, you're blindfolded in solitary confinement, and that's it for days.
Could you say that part of the torture of that plague? I mean, one of your primary senses is taken away from you.
Correct.
Which is really disturbing.
Yes, it is.
And also, it makes me think of, like, the moment when you're at home and you're just sitting there typing on your computer, doing your work, or reading, and then, like that, all of the electricity in the house goes out. That moment of, what the hell? What just happened?
Right, exactly.
But dragged out for 3 days.
Correct. So this is super intense psychological torture. Now I bring to your attention, now I have an interesting question for you. Who would the plague of Makas Choshech have little effect on?
Blind people.
True.
True.
But who
the
else?
Jewish populace.
The Jewish population says that they had light in their district. In the Jewish neighborhoods, they had light. And you guys remember from reading that. Who would not be affected by the Makas Choshech? Or, you know, maybe not to look like real.
Someone who had a lot of faith, a lot of confidence, you know, that.
Why would that make it any less scary?
Because they would know that it's only, like, temporary, right?
Yeah, they'd be fine.
Can I make a suggestion?
Please. Bring it ahead.
I once heard this lecture by Rabbi Twersky.
Yep.
And he described this time he went to like a spa or something, a spa. And one of the activities at the spa is that you go by yourself into this like sauna chamber and they like close you up in there and you're just supposed to like sit in there. So he went in and he tried it and he felt like he had been in there for a really long time. And he wondered why the attendant hadn't come to get him. So he like came out of the spa room and he asked the attendant, how long have I been in there? It feels like a really long time. And the spa attendant said, oh, you've only been in there for like 15 or 20 minutes. So he goes back in and he tries again. And the same thing happened. He thought he'd been in there for a really long time. He felt like it had been hours. And he came out and the attendant said it had only been a short time. And Rabbi Twersky said he realized from this experience that he didn't like himself. He didn't like his own company. He didn't like to be alone with himself. So like with that in mind, like maybe people who are like really comfortable and enjoy their own company would not be as tortured by something like this.
Ruthie, that's an excellent point. In other words, let me give you a less dramatic situation. Has anybody been to a shiva, visited a mourner at a shiva house?
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, and has there any been, if you've been at the shiva house when there is a lull in the conversation?
No.
Okay. Where the Avel stops speaking because, you know, they got nothing else to say. And the mourner and the people who are doing the Nichum Avel and people who are comforting the mourner, their job is to respond to the mourner. So if the mourner is not saying anything, then they can't say anything. Even if that lasts like 2 minutes, people find that excruciating. Excruciating. Now, it's excruciating because when you're in a house of a mourner, it brings to mind very, very quickly some very painful thoughts. Number one, A, there will be my time where I will be a mourner for one of the people that I love, and they will be gone. So that is a very painful thought. That is quickly followed by a thought of like, not only will I will be a mourner, I will actually one day not exist. And that, by the way, is an even more painful thought. So having these types of, having profound or big thoughts about a person's self and their issues, especially if a person does not ever do what they call in Jewish rabbinic literature, cheshbon ha-nefesh. The activity of cheshbon ha-nefesh, which means literally, an assessment of the soul, which is like very simply, tonight, at some point tonight, you're going to go to sleep. And about before you go to sleep, you're going to sit on your bed and you're going to sort of review the day. How did it go? What happened? And then you might realize, well, I made a mistake doing this, and I should have did that. and maybe I need to apologize to this person. And I can't believe if this thing was so important to me, why I didn't do it. So an activity of careful examination of our lives is not something that is intrinsically what people call fun or pleasurable. It is meaningful. In other words, the job of a therapist essentially is to take a person by the hand and to take them on a tour of themselves, the journey into themselves. Because most people are too afraid to walk in the door for themselves. Now, a person who is regularly doing that and views it as being a critical part of their self-improvement has no problem, A, thinking about themselves, and more importantly, thinking about other ideas. You know what I'm saying? In other words, if a person, whenever you've done strenuous thought, you need to be in a state where you're not getting distracted by a YouTube video. You're not reading your texts, your messages, your emails. You're not listening to music. You're not eating. You're in a state of non-distracted self, which, by the way, for a modern person is very, very rare. But if a person is a person who tries to think about things and pushes himself to be a thoughtful person about either ideas separate to themselves. Two, who is thinking about their own behavior, sort of being their own therapist. Then 3 days to themselves, quite frankly, is called not a plague, but a vacation. But most people, those 3 days would be psychological torture and boredom and painful of the worst order. And that's why it is sequenced as the ninth plague, the worst plague. Because basically your whole being is in your head. All of us are in our head all the time. Okay, you know what the therapist did to Dr. Frome was to try to show with him by sharing that your sense of yourself is completely off base, or what Rabbi Twersky, a major part of Rabbi Twersky's psychological work, is the point of that self-esteem or the lack of self-esteem is the critical for psychological happiness. And as he pointed out himself, the reason he didn't be in a sauna or in a room, even for 15 minutes, was unpleasant because his sense of himself was low. But he said he didn't like to be in the company of himself. And by the way, that is not uncommon. So the conversely, if you're a person who is psychologically healthy, be regularly thinking about themselves, or C, more importantly, thinking about things which are beyond themselves, thinking about ideas, and to be able to think about it in an undistracted way is a good thing. It's something that they strive to do. In fact, they're trying to leave the world of distraction into a time where they can be involved in thought. That's a great thing, but it's a rare thing. I mean, but in Judaism, that really is the goal. Each person you cannot be a person who is dedicated to self-growth if you don't spend time either A, you know, thinking about yourself and thinking about your ideas and thinking about the things in your life. Most people are too scared of it, or they're not trained like that, and it's a source of frustration. So they want to be kept in a state of continuous distraction. And now with technology, that desire can be fully realized. From the time you wake up till the time you go to sleep, you can be in a state where there'll always be music. You could have food or drink available always. you can be looking at a screen, or oftentimes multiple screens. Like when my kids watch sports, they don't just watch the game. They're watching the game, but they're also on their phone or on another device looking at ESPN or other, you know, media. They're like distracting their distraction. Okay. So, you know, you could just be, you could be on multiple devices simultaneously. So your mind is completely, you know, shattered with a whole variety of impulses of distractions. And it's very, very, and it's very hard to break free from that. So, the lesson here, so therefore now you understand why I brought up the whole the therapeutic intervention that Dr. Fromm had, because even though he's a therapist, he needed a therapist to be able to take him into his own thinking, his patterns of thought, his sense of self, and to make conscious, bring to the surface, if you will, sort of the irrational thought that he viewed himself being a worthless individual unless he's doing heroic chesed. So here we see an interesting paradox. For the Egyptians who like us did not, you know, live the distracted life, so being forced to have 3 days of boredom and terror was one of the worst plagues, you know, you can possibly imagine, short of death. That's why it's the ninth plague. But conversely, but the Torah, through its various mitzvot, are trying to make each person, each one at their own level, to be a person who thinks about their behavior. How, you know, it's a very critical that after you have, certainly if you have a intense encounter, negative encounter, let's say again, a fight with somebody, a family member, is after the event to stop and go through the, and then roll the tape back and do a self-assessment. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe they were wrong. How could I avoid this result? You know what I'm saying? So to be a thoughtful, reflective person is really the keys for success in life. So I'll say, ironically, if you had the most successful Jew, Makas Choshech would have been no problem. 3 days without distraction to sit and think about my life and whatever, you know, and things which are important to me. What a gift. But for most people, that would be like the worst torture. And it was. And that's why Paro summoned Moshe. Quick, get out of here. We can't take it anymore. And if it wasn't for Hashem hardening Paro's heart, he would have let him go, because that was like the worst thing. We're done. Any questions about this?
So would you say that the closest thing that we have to this today is having like a 3-day yuntif?
Well, by the way, I think you're, so people find like 3 days of yuntif torturous also, because even though they can talk to people and they can eat and they can schmooze and they can walk around, but the fact is they're not able to do the normal distractions, i.e. go to work and watch TV and be on their phone. People find it very challenging. But the reality is, a 3-day Yom Tov, as it's called, or 2 days of Yom Tov plus a Shabbos, is really a spiritual retreat if you're doing it right. Because the fact that you got off from work to be involved in learning, spend some quality time with your family, I'm just saying, people do not know. I saw a glimpse of what life would be. Family life would be without Shabbos and Yom Tov. What happened? I was sitting with my family at the Suda Mafsekes, the last meal of Erev Yom Kippur. Now, as you know, Erev Yom Kippur is not Yom Tov yet. So all my kids came to the table with their phone. So I had everybody around the table, And they were all eating and looking at their phone until I, you know, forbade that. But the natural tendency is not, even if you're sitting with people, is to be on your phone. And even if you put it on the table in front of you, you have the background surveillance just waiting. Might hear a ping? Maybe somebody can message me. A WhatsApp message. An email. Something good. So you're constantly distracted. So Shabbos forces people to be engaged, people in an undistracted way. But you see that people, it's very painful. And that's not even being blindfolded in dark. That's just not being able to go to work and not being able to do their things. And I try to deal with it by, you know, let me either Yontif and Shabbos becomes a sleep-a-thon. Let me remain in my pajamas as long as possible. Or gorging yourself, let me eat 15,000 calories in 26 hours, right? Or both. Eat so much till I fall into a sleep coma, and that becomes Shabbos. Accessing this opportunity is not natural to people. It requires training. It requires opportunities. And just you should know, at MJE, we purposely curate as much as, you know, certainly a Shabbaton, to have programs throughout the entire day. Like Shabbos, boom, you get your Shabbos morning, you'll have shul, there'll be a kiddush, and then we'll have, you know, your people go to lunch, and then we'll have a parsha class, and after rabbi class, and shal shudas. Just be able to make sure that, because people on their own are not going to naturally make the most of their Shabbos. So we purposely try to provide that programming, you know what I'm saying, for that very reason. And then if you ask people on a Shabbaton, were you bored? No, it was great, because everything was like, and they appreciate the fact that they had an opportunity to do all these things. So it's a similar idea. But it takes learning how to do that. To think, in other words, to like time yourself. How long can you think about a problem? You think about a problem more than 15 seconds? 30 seconds, a minute. To build up your mental muscle, to think about a problem, whatever. It could be a personal problem. It could be a problem among others. It could be something you're trying to figure out. But the ability to leave, you know, people are most happy when they're actually not focusing on themselves. It's when they think about themselves, they feel all the other bad emotions start to show up. So that's really that. So that's why Makif Bechoros could be either A, the ninth worst plague, or it could be a vacation, depending on the person. Something to think about. Questions, anyone?
How did you find that video? How did you decide to use it?
All right, so you should also, I'll tell you all my secrets here. All right, so I prepare. All these Parsha classes, as I say on top, are prepared together with Rabbi Sacks. And it takes a lot of time to find, the right video for the class. And remember, I rarely, nearly never, in either the Parsha class or the Senior Fellowship, do I use the same video. So finding videos, by the way, is a hard job. This video, Rabbi Sacks found. But, you know, obviously go to YouTube and searches and different ideas, you know, but it's not simple. But I've, in my 5-6 years of doing video intros to classes, I think most people like it. You know, after a long day, come in, start with a video, discuss it, and then transition into the actual content. It's been an educational structure, class structure that's been working. What do you guys say? You guys like videos?
Love the videos.
Love the videos. Okay, so there you go. So if you love the videos, I'll keep on doing the videos.
It's fun. It starts off the class with it gets it going. You know what I mean?
That's the idea. It brings in the attention because, you know, the Parsha is great, but something from TV or movie, and that, by the way, was a particularly emotionally intense scene, is something that people are going to find more appealing, by and large. All right, guys. Have a great night. Well, I'll see some of you guys at MG tomorrow night. All the best.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're welcome.